On KBOO Portland, I'm Karen James. The U.S. Constitution declares that a person cannot be held in jail without due process. A person suffering with mental illness who is found by the court unable to aid and assist in their own defense cannot be held and punished in jail, but must receive mental health treatment and be restored to competency before prosecution can continue. Oregon is in violation of this basic right, as many pretrial defendants in need of mental health care languish for months in our county jails. In 2022, federal judge Michael Mossman ordered that the state psychiatric hospital begin discharging patients under new restoration limits and reduce wait time for individuals in jail in need of mental health care. My guest is the Honorable Judge Nan Waller of the Multnomah County Circuit Court. Welcome, Judge Waller.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me.
Many people in need of mental health care are instead ending up in the criminal legal system. Yet Oregon lacks mental health services, programs, and housing. County sheriffs argue that jails are not equipped to treat mental illness. The state is facing a lawsuit over this issue. The mental health workforce is in crisis. And some fear that these people released from the state psychiatric hospital under Judge Mossman's new order are dangerous. So, Judge Waller, you are at the heart of all of this, as you are the mental health court judge who manages the aid and assist docket for the court in Multnomah County. How did we get to this point?
I'm going to start off by explaining that I manage two different dockets. I manage mental health court, which is for people who have resolved their cases. It's a probation court and it's a treatment court. Everyone who comes into mental health court has had their charges resolved, usually by way of a plea. And then there's an offer made in terms of entering and completing mental health court as part of the negotiation, if that's how the case resolves. And that is a population that has been found competent, or there's not been an issue of competency. The other docket that I manage is the aid and assist docket. And I'm going to use the word competency because there are different terms used for it, but competency covers the concerns that we're talking about. And you are correct. The idea that people have the competency to proceed before the state can proceed with criminal charges has been around for a very long time. It actually dates back to mid-17th century England, when somebody who was accused, if they were refusing to answer questions, then there would be a process for trying to determine whether they were just being obstinate or whether they were in fact mute. Over history's time, it has become what it is now. And then the U.S. Supreme Court set out the due process requirements in State versus Dusky back in 1960. It is the idea of competency is something that is a cornerstone of the criminal justice system, that before we can proceed, we certainly have made some progress. Back in mid-17th century England, the process of determining whether somebody was being obstinate or whether they were in fact mute was to continue to pile stones on their chest until they either spoke out, and in that case, the determination was they were being obstinate versus simply being mute. I'm sure there was some collateral damage of that process that was very concerning. But it has evolved over the centuries to be an issue of, does the person understand what's going on in terms of the criminal process? Do they have the ability to work with their lawyer and to make decisions? And that is, if they have a mental illness that prevents them from understanding, working with their lawyer and making the kinds of decisions that need to be in a criminal case, then the criminal charges have to be paused while efforts competency occur. And the issues that Oregon is facing now are issues that across the country are many, many states still have issues in terms of the numbers of people. So this is not a unique to Oregon issue, and states are approaching the issues in different ways. I served on the National Task Force to examine state courts' response to mental illness over the last 2 years. And the final report from that task force was released at the end of last year. But there are recommendations in that about how do we look at the issues of competency and how do we, as a country, and how do states individually, what can courts do in terms of looking at how we address the increasing numbers of people who are being found incompetent in the criminal justice system. And I bring that up because I think that it's not unique to Oregon. It's not that we're doing something uniquely wrong. There's no one kind of reason why we've gotten into the position that we are. I think there are lots of hypotheses. There have been articles written. We certainly have seen across the country an increase in numbers of people in the criminal justice system who are found incompetent, whether that's an increase in mental illness, whether it's the lack of what we need in our communities to create a safety net so people don't come into the criminal justice system in the first instance. There are theories that Dr. Bloom, who was a psychiatrist for many years in Oregon, wrote an article and did some research on the high standard, the high bar for civil commitments in Oregon. And his theory was that that was leading to more cases in the competency pipeline. We certainly know that historically, when we look at what happened when President Kennedy had his vision for a transformation of the behavioral health system and the mental health system in this country, it began by closing the large institutions where people were housed, often for years and years and years, with nobody looking at what was happening to them. And then his idea was that there would be a network across the country of community mental health centers that would be the safety net for people who have significant mental health issues to get them what they need in the community. The first part of the plan happened over a period of decades, and large institutions were closed. The second part of the plan, I think there has not, I'm not aware of any state that has fully brought that vision into being of getting a complete network of community mental health centers that act as the safety net for people. We've also seen across the country an increase in homelessness. And, in Oregon, and I think in many other states, we've seen an incredible increase in access to methamphetamine. And methamphetamine is certainly a factor. And I've had many, many people who are coming in front of me who've told me that they use meth because they're homeless. They don't want to sleep at night because they're afraid of what may happen to them. So they use meth, which certainly doesn't help their mental health issues. They don't have medic access to medication. And we're in a position then where we have a lot of people who have significant mental health issues, who are homeless, and who are either self-medicating or using meth in a way that is, as a precaution against the dangers of living out in the community unhoused. I think all of that are those are probably all contributing factors. I think another factor that I've begun to see research on is the issue of the level of loneliness in this country. Years ago, I went to hear a researcher from the Institute of Happiness in Norway. Who talked about the increase in loneliness in the US? They do a lot of research around the world on loneliness and happiness. And that with the advent of smartphones, they began to see an increase in loneliness in this country, especially among young adults and adolescents. They didn't make the connection, but when you begin to think about how we, the casual ways that we interact with each other, the sense of community. We no longer, go to a bank. We all do everything electronically. We often don't pick up the phone. We text and that is can be very isolating for people. The people that I see, both in terms of my mental health court population and the aid and assist population, are often very lonely people. They've burned a lot of bridges in terms of their family relations, their community relationships. And they don't have a lot of connection. And I think that we know that there are certain things that we all need as human beings. We need a sense of purpose. We need housing. We need social connection and relationships. And so I think all of the things that I've just gone over, probably spending more time than you wanted me to in asking that question, are contributors to the increase in the numbers of people who are in the criminal justice system because it is an open door. There are oftentimes people can't get treatment in the community because there are access issues to treatment. They are considered too volatile, too agitated, so many things. And the door that is open is the criminal justice door. And so, I think that everyone is trying hard not to have the inconsequential cases come in through the criminal justice door. But I think that there are certain things that we know that would be helpful in our community in order to help close the door a bit to the criminal justice system and get people what they need. An alternative to jail that is easy for people to navigate and have access to. a group of us from Oregon went to Arizona a year and a half ago, I think it was, to look at their crisis assessment and center and stabilization center, where they've made it very easy for law enforcement, rather than dropping people off who are in a mental health crisis, to drop them off at the intervention and the stabilization and assessment center. And so we've been looking, there's a group in Multnomah County and other parts of the state also who've been looking at, can we have an alternative to jail that will be just as easy for first responders to drop somebody off as it would be for jail? And so that's, I think, one opportunity. But we know that we absolutely do not have what we need in the community. And hearkening back to President Kennedy's vision, we do not have the access for the population, especially for anybody who's been in the criminal justice system or is currently in the criminal justice system. There are many programs that have charge-based exclusions, or they look at the population and think, ah, these, too agitated, too potentially risky, too violent, all of the things that one can say, and we can't get people into the level of treatment that they need. So I think that there are, I think we know what we need to do. The question is going to be, can we get there in terms of providing the safety net in the community in the first instance to prevent some people from ever getting into the criminal justice system? For those who are having contact with first responders, can we provide an alternative to jail when it's appropriate? And there's some cases where the behavior is so serious that probably it may be that they end up in jail in the first instance. But can we figure out paths of diversion from jail? And then, in terms of the aid and assist population, how are we going to make sure that people get the level of treatment that they need? In the first goal should be, can we safely get people treatment in the community? And that means that we need a range of community placement. Some people will need to go to a hospital to get stabilized because the level, the acuity of their symptoms is great. The public safety risks are significant. And so we need them to be someplace that is safe and secure. But we also need in the community, for those people who do not need a hospital level of care, there are times when people need, at least initially, to start off in a secure setting, someplace where they can't just walk out the door. Addiction is, has a powerful draw for a lot of people. And we need to be able to at least stabilize people enough to the point where they're going to be able to function in a less restrictive setting, which is always going to be our goal. Can we get people to the place where they are getting the treatment that they need, the support that they need? Restoration is a fairly limited, it's not the door to all mental health treatment. It is to restore people for the purposes of the fact that they have criminal charges that are pending. So I think that in addition to addressing the issues of competency and the competency system and the fact that we are, the hospital is over capacity, the community options are over capacity. We have people who we believe that we have a good fit for them in the community, but they're waiting lists. And so that's where we need an increase of the options available. But we also know that we need, generally, in order to keep people out of the criminal justice system, we need the full range of mental health and substance abuse treatment available in the community to meet people where they are. It can't be often for the people that I see. You can't say, well, you have an appointment in 2 weeks. Please show up for it when they have no housing, they don't have transportation, they don't have a way of keeping track. If we operate like that and then the person fails to show up and people say, see, not really committed, instead of looking at us and saying, well, we didn't set this up, we didn't create a path of access that will allow people to get the treatment they need where they are when they need it. So I'm hoping that we can have that transformation. There have been some great articles. There was a New York Times editorial a few months ago about saying we know the path to get where we need to be. We need to go back to kind of that vision of community mental health centers that reach people where they are. And then I think we also need to change our, as a public, our how we view mental illness. I work downtown at the courthouse, and the numbers of times I've seen somebody in a mental health crisis walking down the street, and people have their smartphones out and they're taking pictures because the person is, babbling or, talking to somebody who isn't there. That's not a compassionate approach to people with mental illness. And I look at, as I indicated before, that the people that I deal with are a very isolated group of people. They are lonely. They don't feel accepted. And I think that we need to look at mental illness and accept mental illness is part of just like any other physical problem, that it is something that some people suffer from, and we need to accept that, and we need to figure out ways of having people feel accepted by the community. There was a study done many years ago of first world countries and third world countries, and at that time they were looking at what was then called Axis One diagnosis. So major depression, schizophrenia, bipolar, and where were their better outcomes? I think that people were shocked to find that the better outcomes were in the third world country. And one of the conclusions was, when you truly have villages and you don't have places where you can kind of shut people out of sight, out of mind, people are accepted. That's part of being human, that sense of that need for acceptance of who you are. Obviously, we want it safe for our communities, but I think that there are ways that we can both have people provide people that sense of acceptance and keep with enough services and supports across the whole continuum and keep it safe in our communities. And then when somebody really does something, then we should have a compassionate approach to how we deal with behavior that really is beyond the bounds that we need to continue to process through the criminal justice system. But we can do that in a way that is compassionate.
And Judge Waller, can you talk about some of the people who come before you and some of the innovative steps you've taken?
Sure. The people I see are often people who have significant mental illness that is interfering with their ability to work with their lawyer, understand the process, and make the kinds of decisions that need to be made. A number of years ago, we sometimes would see less serious charges coming through the competency system. And the case that really stands out is a man who had a delusion about the airport. Every chance he got, he would go out to the airport and he would create a fuss in a public. It would be, the airport's a busy place, people are trying to get to airplanes, and the Port Authority police would remove him, bring him to the jail, and he was found incompetent. And eventually, charges would be dismissed. If there had been an option other than jail, I think that everybody would have welcomed that. And because the criminal process was such, the maximum period of time that somebody can be under the statute as it was before Judge Mossman's order, the maximum period of time that somebody on a criminal trespass could have been held in custody or at the state hospital was 30 days. Probably not long enough to get most people restored. And so that I think that's a good example of when you look at, there needed to be an alternative because clearly the airport needed to have the ability to function without somebody creating a fuss, impeding as people were trying to get to planes and things. But there needed to be an alternative than jail because we weren't going to get him through the restoration process. Eventually, he was civilly committed, but he was arrested a lot of times before we got to that point. I'm not seeing charges like criminal trespass coming on to the, unless they're more serious charges that the person is also being charged with at this point, because people recognize, the DA's office recognizes, really, we don't have with 30 days restoration maximum. That's not sufficient. But we need an alternative, which is when I was talking about the idea of having an assessment and stabilization center. I think that that would be the ideal place to get somebody what they need and then be able to stabilize them, knowing that we have the next step available. So, housing, supportive housing. We need for some people who have significant long-term mental illness. It can't be that we do kind of the short-term fix and then we say, great, you've been restored, good luck. Or we can't, for this individual, after he was committed, there needed to be long-term opportunities for him to continue to get the support. In the other side of my mental health job as a judge in mental health court, I look at some people who are saying, gosh, I'm not ready to graduate, because there is that sense of acceptance, people feeling like a sense of belonging. I mean, some people want to get off of probation as quickly as possible, but there are people who also, it provides some sense of purpose and some sense of coming and being accepted. Somebody who knows your name and is going to support you. And then, if things aren't going well, say, well, here's some other options that we can try. In terms of the Judge Mossman, in looking at the overcapacity of the state hospital, Dr. Pynals, who's the neutral expert who was brought in by the court, recommended that Oregon look at the length of time of commitment to the state hospital as one way of freeing up beds in the state hospital. And so Judge Mossman, in his order from late summer, imposed those timelines that were recommended. So we went from a maximum of 3 years commitment on a felony charge to 6 months on a felony charge, and a year for Measure 11 charges, and a maximum of 90 days for a Class A misdemeanor. And we're in the process. We're getting notices now of people who are being discharged from the state hospital under the new timelines. There is still an obligation, I believe, in the statute, because it was just the one section of the statute that was addressed, the length of commitment to the state hospital, to attempt to restore people in the community. People are still at the end of those timelines if they haven't been found able, and the notices that we're getting are all people who are still unable to aid and assist, that we make efforts in the community to get them restored. And so we are scrambling to try to find our partners at the county. The community mental health providers are scrambling to find placements. And for people who were doing restoration in the community, you need housing. It would be hard for anyone to engage in restoration services who is unhoused, who doesn't have access to mental health treatment, including medication, who has too ready access to methamphetamine and no supports and treatment to keep them from using. I think that would be a very hard go. And that's what we're finding, is that it's not just the placement, but it's the other things that when somebody is in the state hospital, they don't have access, presumably, to controlled substances. They are provided their medication. They're in a therapeutic setting where people are saying, okay, it's time to take your medication. You know, they're being encouraged to do so. And so we need to do some in the community. We need to replicate some of that to the best that we can in order to give people half a chance to be able to effectively engage. In the first instance, when people are found unable, you know, there is a consultation that is done to see if we can get them placement in the community with services and supports and restoration services being provided. So that's always the first goal. But as I indicated earlier, we're seeing that our placements in the community now have waiting lists. So we're holding people in custody, waiting for community placement. We're also, people are in jail waiting for placement still at the state hospital. The original Mink decision, Judge Painter wrote that as a matter of due process, people shouldn't be held waiting for transport to the state hospital for longer than 7 days, and allow people to languish in jail who have significant mental health needs and are unable for weeks and months is a violation of their due process. So the case was brought back when the length of time, as the numbers increased of people coming into the system, as the numbers increased and the numbers of people found incompetent, as cases increased, the numbers of people found incompetent went up kind of at a proportional rate, but it's just more people coming in. Then the wait times for transport to the state hospital started to lengthen. And right now, anecdotally, I could probably look up on a dashboard to tell you exactly, but it looks like we're still about 4 weeks out, 5 weeks out. And of course, in the middle of all of this, we had the pandemic, which slowed down everything. Every community program reduced its population in order to give people more space. The state hospital came up with an elaborate process for, you know, bringing people in, making sure that they were didn't have COVID, and then and that all took, you know, took more beds, it took more time, and so we had many things coming together at once that really made the situation worse, and now we're trying to dig out of it. And the legislature has put in a tremendous amount of money into the behavioral health system in the last several sessions. My hope is that we can make sure some of that is designated specifically for the population in the criminal justice system, so that we have more placements available, that people can't simply be rejected across the board from community placements, that we figure out ways that we can safely keep people in communities, whether it's more support for programs or the level of staffing that people have. And of course, as you indicated, we're in the middle of a behavioral health workforce crisis. So, even though there are placements that could have more beds, they can't because they don't have the staffing. So I'm hoping that we can see a clear path to creating the kind of community support system that we need. Won't solve all of the issues, but it will certainly go a long way to hopefully reduce the numbers of people who are getting to the point where they are entering the criminal justice system.
So, Judge, the Oregon legislature will be in full session this year, 2023, and you just presented to the legislature in December of last year about this issue. So, what do you see as some of what is needed? What did you talk to the legislators about?
Well, I talked to the legislature about the fact that, and I think that everyone would agree, we need more beds in the community, we need more treatment, and we need to make sure that some of it is designated specifically for the criminal justice population. We have an entitlement, and now we have it's part of our constitution, to health care, including behavioral health care. And so when I look and I think I have people who I cannot get into the level of treatment that they need in the community, they are entitled to mental health care. They are entitled to substance abuse. But if there's no place that will accept them, then we need to change how, from my perspective as a judge, we need to look at, is there a different way of doing this so that we are certain that everyone who needs treatment that they are entitled to is getting the level of treatment that they need. So I would hope that we would be able to really look at how do we make sure that people in the justice system are getting access to the level of treatment that they need, and that they're, whether, I mean, I can think of ways that you might do that, but I think it needs to be a very deliberate, there needs to be some deliberate intentional thought behind how we go about and do that. Because right now, we have enough people in our state with behavioral health issues. I mean, Oregon, is down at the bottom of all of the states, so that programs, and I understand from a program's perspective that they would want to choose people that they think will work best in their program, but you still have people who need help and who are being rejected, and someone needs to have some responsibility for providing them with the level of treatment that they need.
Are you finding that people who are coming before you are being refused treatment or housing?
Oh, yes. In the competency process, referrals are sent out by the community mental health providers and the county behavioral health staff, and we have people turn, who are rejected from, or their application, the referral is denied because the person is seen as too risky, or their symptoms are too acute. On the mental health court side of my job, we have people who are being rejected because of the nature of their charges. And I'm not saying that it's easy, but I think that we need to look for solutions even for those problems that are complex and not easy. So, if you have an arson charge, it's almost impossible to get somebody into a residential treatment program. Same with sex offenses. It's impossible to get people housing, often. And so we have people who are, for mental health court, we take high risk, high needs people, and we want them to be housed. We want them to have the level of treatment that they need. And so it's a constant struggle, because for mental health court, oftentimes the alternative is mental health court or prison. And we want people who are mentally ill to get treatment in the least restrictive placement. And I think most people would agree that prison is not going to be, it's not the best place for people to get their mental health treatment needs met. I send people to prison. Sometimes prison is the option that needs to be given the behavior that has been charged and the level of charges. But we know that there that shouldn't be that people who might otherwise, but for the charges, we would be able to serve in the community if we had the right level of treatment. We should have the treatment available, from my perspective as a judge. And on the competency side, there is just often, it's not just a matter of not having enough beds, it's also a matter of having beds that will accept the level of acuity of the people that we have. And that means that we need a much broader continuum of supports than we currently have available.
So you talked about secured housing. Some people need more than just housing.
Some people do fine in non-secure housing. They just need some good support, and they need people around them who are providing the support that they need. But some people, especially when they're very acute in their symptoms, or they have significant substance abuse issues, they need a secure placement, at least initially, to stabilize. We've had people that we've tried to place in the community who have lasted sometimes, and we've tried to step them down from the state hospital, and they've not lasted more than a couple of hours in the community before taking off, because they're in a transitions are hard for all of us. And so going from an institution where you can't leave, where there's lots of structure, to the doors open and you can leave, is very hard for some people. And when they have issues of addiction that have been untreated, which they're not getting substance abuse treatment in the state hospital, that becomes very difficult for people. And we see that people leave, and then, we certainly don't want people ending up back in the system because they end up with new charges. That's not good for them. It's not good for the community.
So, Judge Waller, can you talk more about Judge Mossman's restoration timelines, that they are based on national data? And are we releasing people from the state hospital who are ready to be released?
I think that there are, under the timelines, whether somebody is ready to be released or not, we're getting notices that they are going to be released. There are people who the hospital determines are ready to place in the community because the acuity of their symptoms has stabilized. We get notices about those. Then we have a hearing, and a judge makes a decision based upon the evidence as to whether or not they are ready to place, and there are statutory criteria that need to be met in order for that, for the person to be continued at the hospital or for the person to be placed in the community. Judge Mossman issued his order with timelines that aren't looking at whether the person is ready to be stepped down from the hospital. They're simply timelines that say the person can, this kind of a case, the person can only be in the hospital for 6 months. And so regardless of whether the person is ready to be stepped down from the hospital, if we get the notice, then we need to come up with a plan for them, if we can. And we can't always. I mean, there are times when we have no placement in the community that will accept them, or an individual, who doesn't want to work with treatment, or who says, I will not take medication if I'm in the community. I don't want to work with anybody on restoration.
So the Oregon State Hospital has just begun releasing these people under Judge Mossman's new order. So what is happening?
We've begun to have the hearings on, can we come up with a plan? I mean, I think everyone is always going to want to try to come together, which is good. I'm a strong believer in collaboration, at looking at, can we come up with a plan that is meets the person's needs and is safe for the community? The difficulty is, as I indicated, is that we don't have the level of placements in the community that will provide for an individual or accept an individual. And in that instance, then there are other options that the statute indicates that we are to look to, whether a civil commitment process can be initiated, whether or not there's a guardianship. Both of those are things that are probably civil commitment. The bar is high when people have been in an institution, making the findings necessary to initiate a civil commitment process may be difficult in many instances. Guardianship, the public guardian's office, there's not probably the level of capacity, and there's still the issue of, and then where are people going to be placed, even if there is a guardian, to have the same issue of capacity in terms of numbers of placements, access to treatment. And then finally, there's the option of dismissal. People can't be left in jail untreated.
And Dr. Pinall's report, the independent expert, she did say that approximately 1% were dismissed predisposition. So is that an opportunity to dismiss more of these cases?
Dismissal is an option that should be used as a last resort. the cases that I see, there is often a person who's a victim, whether it's a contempt charge, an elderly parent who has had to go to the extreme of getting a restraining order against their mentally ill adult child who has wants to be able to live their life without somebody coming and banging on the windows and disrupting them. And it's not a nothing charge from the perspective of the victim. It's not something that is simply they're going to have to continue to live with the impact on their life if it's simply dismissed, the person coming back. And I don't, the criminal justice system isn't, the solution for all problems, but it does sometimes provide, when people it can be restored, it provides some structure so that there's some ability to manage an individual's behavior and respond when things are not going well. So I dismissal is certainly an option. When charges are filed and somebody is mentally ill, it's not the mental illness. It may be that the mental illness is part of what leads to behavior, but it's the behavior that is the person is engaging in that is leading to the charges. When somebody breaks into somebody's home, certainly their mental illness may be a factor, but I think that as a community, and we see that our community is distressed sometimes at the justice system's inability to, from the perspective of the community, respond. And so I think that there is a need for community education at the same time as we increase our availability of resources in the community. So yes, dismissal is an option, but it is one that we should look at very closely in terms of it's not my decision as a judge as to what kinds of cases are going to be charged. My job is to, when people are in the competency process, is to do everything I can to provide them with the supports that they need and the treatment that they need so that they can be restored. At times, dismissal is the only option that is left available.
It's a vicious cycle.
It is. And as a judge, I mean, somebody who is clearly very mentally ill and saying, okay, there's nothing that we can offer. There was a case a while ago where the person was at end of jurisdiction. He had serious charges, but the district attorney's office said that they didn't believe that there were any other options that were available, and the only option left was dismissal of the case. And so that does happen, and that was what. But it would have been great if there were some for this very mentally ill person who had been institutionalized for 2 years, if there was some other warm handoff that could have been done to, even though the criminal justice system was, closing its door, that could have been done. I mean, he turned to me and said, "Well, now what am I supposed to do?" And to not have an answer, to say to this person, "I have no idea where you're going to stay tonight. You've been given medication for the past 2 years, which, hasn't fully helped you, but, good luck. And if that's something that you want to continue to pursue, you're going to have to navigate that." That does not seem like a humane way of treating people, that there should be the ability to have a plan. And it's not that people aren't trying, it's just that we don't have enough in order for that kind of warm handoff to be able to be made. I mean, I've had on the mental health court side, I tell a story about one of my participants who came to court one day. I was the only, I think my clerk was in the courtroom. He didn't have a hearing. It was in one of the really cold, I think it was 2 years ago, and it was incredibly cold weather. It was still at the height of the pandemic, and most public buildings were closed. The courthouse stayed open during the pandemic because we do business, regardless of the pandemic. We still continue to have to process cases and be available for people to resolve their disputes. And he came in and he looked, I mean, he was in, clearly had been out sleeping on the street in the absolute frigid weather. And he said, Judge, take me into custody. I'm in every kind of crisis." And I said, "Well, I don't have any basis to take you into custody. I can't do that." And he started crying and said, "Just take me into custody. That's what I need right now." He was exhausted. He was dehydrated. He was extremely cold. He fell asleep on the floor of our courtroom, and we tried to, make calls and try to get somebody to come help him. And finally, We were able to get, an emergency responder to come, and they were going to take him to a hospital. And he was leaving. He thanked me for trying, and he said, "But I'm sure I'll be released by tomorrow." And he was correct. That's exactly what happened. I understand the issue of people voluntarily making treatment choices and all. Here was somebody who absolutely wanted help to the point where he thought jail was a safer place for him to be than out on the streets. And as a judge, all I had to offer was, some water, a bit of food, floor of my courtroom for a bit so he could thaw out. It did not seem like a good option, and that there should have been a place where he could have gone, where he wasn't going to just be turned back out again.
What does that say about us as a society?
Well, I think that in terms of mental illness, we are not the most accepting of societies, and I hope that that changes because I think that that's part of what will spur more action to get in our communities what we need. I know that our community wants to be a compassionate community. A few months ago, there was a woman who had engaged in some behavior that had made the news, and I was asked if, I mean, our courtrooms are open to the press unless there's some very specific findings that can be made, and they wanted to come to the competency hearing to film her. And she was in really bad shape, but I said, yes, we're open courtrooms, including to the press. And I thought, she was kind of on the floor and talking kind of word salad. And I thought, oh, this is titillating. It's not going to be helpful for people to see this. But what surprised me is there'd been a lot of press about her behavior and how outrageous it was. I got calls from people who I hadn't heard from for a while saying, oh my goodness, we had no idea. What's our compassionate response? And I thought, well, I don't ever want people to be, I didn't really want her to be filmed for her own sense of dignity. But I was surprised that people, when actually understanding and seeing what, that this wasn't somebody who was making necessarily volitional choices about her behavior, but she was somebody who was very ill, it reframed the behavior for people. So I'm hoping that we can do that. That we can, as a society, really accept. I think that we, it is a portion of our population that is very vulnerable and is, people want still out of sight, out of mind. And I get that. Everybody has a right to have a community that where they feel safe and comfortable in their own homes, where they feel like they have, they can walk outside and not, be accosted. I get that. But we also then need to make sure that we're providing what people who are very mentally ill need, and do so in a compassionate way where people are getting what they need, they have a sense of acceptance, they have the relationships, the treatment that they need. And that, I think, is on all of us as members of the community. PBS did has started a Ken Burns series, and the first part of it was Hiding in Plain Sight. It's on mental illness in this country. Really well done. And I hope that people watch it because it's people coming in front of me are oftentimes it's much easier for them to say, oh, it's just all I have a meth addiction than admit to having a mental illness because it's still seen there's so much stigma still involved in mental illness, far more than people struggling with substance abuse issues, I think, from the perspective that I sit in as a judge.
So this will take compassion from all of us and the will from our leadership. And again, the Oregon legislature will be working on many bills this year dealing with mental health. And to our listeners, that website is www.oregonlegislature.gov, G-O-V. And that's where you can find out who represents you. You can find out which bills they will be working on this session. You can track the bills or you can testify. So, Judge Waller, any thoughts about the legislature?
I'm going to be optimistic. I think that this is an area where the legislature has a great deal of interest. We have some great legislative leaders who are very interested in behavioral health issues. We have Governor Kotek has indicated that homelessness and behavioral health are two of her top issues. I believe that the city of Portland and Multnomah County locally realize that these are issues that absolutely have to be addressed, that our community is wanting a response to what they are seeing. So I'm going to be optimistic that we're going to get there, but I think that it also takes every single person in the community to step up, both in terms of their compassion to those that they see, as well as their advocacy for those who are very vulnerable. And then I hope that we just understand the need to both understand mental illness and embrace it as we do anything else that people are affected by. People have any kind of a physical health issue, we respond. If somebody has a heart attack, boy, are there people there. We don't have the same kind of response if it's a behavioral health issue. So I'm going to be optimistic for the new year, and I hope that everyone else joins together and really looks at how do we help this very vulnerable population and how do we empower them. People need to feel like they count. They have some humanity and dignity that is being respected.
Judge Nan Waller, thank you so much.
Thank you.